And we do have some time for questions. But while you're thinking of your questions, I'm going to ask the three ushers to come up. We're going to take a free will offering for those that would like to help us run this ministry. We'd appreciate that. Don't feel compelled, but if you're going to do that, you're welcome to do that. So I'm going to run the mic around, and for those that have questions, put your hand up, and I'll bring the mic by you, and you can ask your question.
Yes, I saw on YouTube a discussion between Russell Humphreys and John Baumgartner, and they were discussing the fact that the majority of scientists have a misunderstanding about what the theory even is, and this idea about the Copernican principle and that, you know, we can't be in a special place and all that. Mm-hmm. But they referred to the question of, you know, does the universe have a center and does it have edges? Could you talk about that a little bit and what the misunderstanding is about the Big Bang in that respect?
So we observe redshifts all around us. That means galaxies are moving away from us. There's a few close by ones that we're in a group with that aren't doing that, but everything further out is all moving away. And the farther out it is, the faster it's moving away. Now, there's two possible options. Let me put it this way. We appear to be at the center of an expanding universe. So there's two possible options. A, we appear to be at the center of an expanding universe because we are. Or B, we appear to be at the center of an expanding universe, but it would look that way regardless of where you were within the universe. Hubble chose option B. And the cosmological principle is the idea, as you touched on, that there's no center and no edge to the universe because there can be no special place. If there can be no special place, then there can be no center because the center would be a special place. And there can be no edge either because that would be special compared to somewhere else. So the universe can have no center and no edge. And they make that fundamental assumption and then build, with Einstein's relativity, cosmological models. But that's an assumption, because we've never been outside of our solar system, never mind our galaxy or galaxy cluster. We have no observational way of knowing what the universe would look like from way over there. So they assume that it would look the same from anywhere. And in fact, frequently in science articles, it's presented as a discovery or an observation. But it's an assumption. It's not either of discovery or observation. It's merely an assumption. If you make the different assumption that maybe we appear to be at the center of an expanding universe because we are. Now, we don't have to be at the exact center, but just somewhere close enough to it for it to look this way. Then you apply relativity to a model of the universe, you get a much different picture. Now you start having gravitational wells you can have a center of mass and all sorts of other things, and then several creation cosmologies are built on that. And tonight I didn't have time to talk about a creationist view of cosmology. We could do a whole presentation just on that. Like I mentioned at the beginning, I'm focusing on debunking the secular side of things. But physicists who are Bible believers have questioned the assumption you're bringing up and saying, well, why can't there be a special place? I mean, the earth is apparently the center of God's attention. You know, the Lord took on human flesh and came here. That's, you know, very much special attention. So maybe we are at a special place. And if so, what would that look like? And then you apply the math and you wind up with a very different model of the universe where, among other things, you can have starlight come from objects that are millions or billions of light years away, yet a clock on Earth has only measured 6,000 years since creation. So it all keys back to that initial assumption. So thank you for bringing that up. Yes, sir.
So what year approximately did this theory of the Big Bang come into effect?
It was around in the 40s and 50s, but it wasn't really popular. Steady state tended to be the more dominant one, which says that the universe is eternal. It was the discovery of the cosmic microwave background in 64, 65 that really boosted the Big Bang up, and the other secular cosmologies sort of fell by the wayside. Because the other ones couldn't explain the CMB, but the Big Bangers had predicted it. So the model really took off in the mid-60s, and it's been pretty much the dominant one ever since.
Let me just add of that book, The Privileged Planet, that discusses some of the issues you were talking about, the fine-tuning.
Oh, yes.
And also, you know, we're at the center, or close to the center of the universe.
I don't remember it talking about that.
Yeah.
That would surprise me, because Guillermo Gonzalez, to my knowledge, wouldn't believe that.
Yeah, it discusses that.
Okay, well, I haven't.
Okay, any other?
A number of years ago, I saw that.
Questions?
Surprised nobody asked about Boltzmann brains. I have a couple minutes. Do you want to hear why the Big Bang model says such a ridiculous thing? Yeah? I mean, because it'll help you share the idea with others, if nothing else, which is one of the reasons we have these meetings. Okay, so imagine you're a scientist in a lab, and here's your lab bench, and you're studying gases. So you've got like a glass aquarium, and there's some gas in there, air, whatever it may be, and it's sealed all the way around. And you've got various instruments that measure the density and temperature and pressure and everything else. And you're in there that morning, and you look at all your instruments, and you see there's uniform pressure throughout the whole system. Okay? You turn your back, and you're doing some other stuff, and you turn around, and you notice your instruments are registering a higher pressure, denser spot right here. And then as you watch, it dissipates until it's all equal again. So what's going on here? Well, the first thing you do is you go look and you make sure that there was no external thing that could have caused this little dense patch in the gas. So for example, this room, there's all gas molecules in here. They're all bouncing against each other. There's, you know, however many gazillions of them in here. The air pressure in here is roughly equal, right? Now, it's not impossible, in theory, that they could make smaller clumps of higher dense gas here and there. In fact, they're probably doing that. It's just below our ability to perceive that. What's the likelihood, though, that as they're all moving around, bouncing off of each other, that they're all going to wind up in that corner of the room and leave a vacuum out here for us to be gasping for air? That's possible, but very, very unlikely. In fact, you'd have to wait billions of years for a room of this size to even, you know, have a chance of doing such a thing. Well, you know all this in your mind, so you're looking at this aquarium, you say, okay, there's this dense patch that's then dissipated. Now, the dissipation doesn't surprise you because that's how gases behave. You know, if I have a can of compressed air and I spray, it's higher dense, some of you have seen this demonstration on my DVD or whatever, you spray compressed air, it goes from a denser system to a lesser denser system, it equalizes itself, right? It doesn't go the opposite way. It goes from denser or higher pressure to lower pressure. Well, same thing here. Once the higher pressure clump in the thing was formed, it then dissipates till it's all even again. But you've checked, and there's nothing that could have caused this in your lab. There's no external source of heat, or there wasn't an earthquake. I mean, there wasn't. You think of all the possibilities, and they're all not. So you're forced to conclude that just as the molecules are moving around, bouncing off each other, they all just happen to wind up in a more localized clump and dissipate. Or is that really what happened? Do you instead conclude that what really happened was a much, much denser clump formed when your back was turned, and that was what was in the process of dissipating when you turned around? You understand the two options? Option number one is that the clump formed and then dissipated. Option number two is that a much, much denser clump formed and was in the process of dissipating back when you turned around and saw it in the middle of that process. Is everybody confused yet? My point is, it's unlikely for that clump to have formed, but you're forced to acknowledge, well, apparently that's what happened because there's no other reason for it. You're not going to accept, though, that it was actually a much denser clump when your back was turned, because that's exponentially more unlikely. If the slightly dense clump is exponentially unlikely to have happened, the far denser clump is exponentially unlikely. See the logic so far? Now apply this to the universe. If the universe fluctuated into existence, what is the likelihood that it would have formed something 14 billion years ago that evolved to the universe we are in right now? Thermodynamics says entropy will always increase. Now, physicists have taken thermodynamics and applied it to different ways. One of the implications is, in effect, things get less and less complicated, if I can use that. Statistically, things get more and more likely over time, is another way of putting that. So if the universe has been around for 14 billion years, and its complication, you know, its complication level today, its unlikeliness is, you know, whatever number, express that as entropy, it must have been far more unlikely 14 billion years ago. So the analogy is, you just turned around in your lab, and you see today's universe sitting there. Do you say it fluctuated to this density, which is already unlikely enough? Or do you say it fluctuated to this far, far, far more unlikely little clump where all the gas was in one corner and the vacuum everywhere else, and then it's dissipating back, and that's when you turn your back? You see the analogy now? Today's universe, as complicated as it is, I mean, as complicated as our brains are, 7 billion people in the world, each with this amazingly complicated mass of tissue in our skulls, as complicated as the universe is today, as unlikely as the universe is today, it would have been far more unlikely 14 billion years ago, because statistically it has to get more and more likely as time progresses. Have I lost anybody yet? Most people. Anyway, point is, as unlikely as it is for the universe to have suddenly popped all of us into existence 10 seconds ago, where you didn't actually come in here and watch a presentation an hour ago, because that's all an illusion, it's a false memory that came with your brain. In fact, you can't even be sure anybody else exists but you. You might be the only one. There's one brain, everybody in this room is an illusion, your entire lifetime to this point is a false memory, that's all part of the illusion. Not that it matters, because you're about to fluctuate back into thermodynamic soup anyway in a few seconds from now. But that is far, as unlikely as that is, for a brain to pop into existence with false senses and false memories and illusions, that is far more likely to have happened than the entire universe to have popped into existence 14 billion years ago and get more and more statistically likely over time to where we are. Does that make sense? Or did I just lose everybody?
It's
a strange idea, but when you really grasp, well, okay, I'll shut up.
You have tackled one of the most difficult sciences, of course. You know, in creation, the three big things that I see is biology, geology, and astronomy / cosmology. Of those three, this is the most difficult one. So I laud you for tackling this one.
for being so foolish as to, hey, angels fear to tread, let's go.
Yeah. But again, let's give him a hand for his presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.